tonight on Arena. Singer-songwriter Karen Casey on her new show, I Walked Into My Head. And Alan Carr helps us celebrate 20 years of management hell in the office. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Singer-songwriter Karen Casey has enjoyed a strong solo career on the Irish trad and folk scene since the late 1990s and her early days as the member of the band Sullis. She's about to play a gig with a difference at this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. It's called I Walked Into My Head, and Karen has worked with director Sophie Motley to create a show that is part song poem, part music performance. Fans will be glad to hear she has new songs to sing. She also has stories to tell from her life on the road as a touring musician and from her experiences of family, motherhood and loss. And delighted to have Karen join me on the programme this evening. I think it was last January, around the time of Tradfest, that we last spoke, Karen, and that seems like a long time ago now, doesn't it? Now, you were starting, I remember at that time, there was you were talking about prose as well as songs happening at that point in time. Did you keep it a secret from me that you were actually writing a theatre show?
I suppose I did. Well, to be fair to myself, I've been writing, you know, prose for a long time and poetry, and I often try to hammer them into songs in a way. And so it was really great fortune that Olga Barry and the Kilkenny Arts Festival invited me to put on this show. And they really have looked after me. You know, I've been having just such an amazing time in this theatre world, which I'm not really very used to. You know, you go into a room and you develop your words or your music in collaboration. So I've had the tremendous fortune. I worked earlier with the wonderful Alwyn Fuere, and then I've been working over the past 2 or 3 months with Sophie Motley, who I have to say I'd follow through fire. She's really helped me, you know, from reading.
Yeah, because I'm guessing for you, like, you're well used, Karen, to writing the material for songs coming up and presenting it to you. And then, as you say, you hammer that into poetry or into a song, as the case may be. Was there something about the type of stuff that you were looking at around this time that you just thought, this isn't going to work just as a song? I'm not going to get there with this material in that way.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. I mean, you know, often when I speak on stage, often when I sing on stage, I think you can hide a little bit behind the lovely balm of the melody. But when you speak, it creates a different atmosphere in the room. And I suppose many of the stories are very personal. And beautiful and joyous, but some of them are difficult. Mm. And I felt I wanted a new way of approaching them and to try something creative. I wanted to kind of walk into my head and explore areas and then be a creative person in how I would deliver that.
Of course, when you walk into your own head, you might encounter parts of yourself that you weren't particularly keen, first of all, on meeting, and then secondly, on sharing with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
How difficult was that aspect?
Well, you know, some of it has been very freeing and liberating. You know, I have my mother. I conjured my mother up as a heron, and she comes to collect me. My mother passed away, and she comes down to collect me, and she takes me through Cork City, and we kind of, you know, explore Cork. And then I have other scenes where I'm traveling in vans, or there's a scene in Heathrow where I'm, you know, busy being on tour, heading off to America. And then I look down and I see my red boots from when I crossed over the field this morning, and they're, you know, caked and covered in mud, and I'm taken to another place with my child when I dropped her off to school. So,
Let me just go back to your mother and that story of the heron. When did she actually pass away, Karen?
10 years ago. And I think, you know, I think I've pretty, not to do her a disservice, actually, she probably preferred to be something like a peacock, but I have fairly much processed my mother's death with this art. It's kind of a spine that that runs through the whole piece. And I suppose me coming to terms with that and kind of growing into her in a way, and then continuing that conversation with my children, because there's another scene where I'm remembering breastfeeding my eldest daughter in the ward, and we kept the whole ward awake for half the night. You know, so there's different elements. Aspects.
But it's interesting. Yes. It's interesting that it's 10 years later that you're processing, as you say yourself, that you're in some ways dealing with your mother's death through this work of art, as it were. Do you think that it just was it something that you couldn't touch previous to that, or had you done it with the balm of a melody, to use your own phrase again, around you in some of the songs up to this, but this was a chance to really bring it to a new place?
Yeah, I mean, I had written her numerous songs. And I suppose it's more channeling her grit and her defiance and her will to survive, through myself and the next generation. And I suppose we're all, the whole world is having a conversation probably about death.
Yeah.
So that was very much in the ether. I do think the lockdown did afford me the opportunity, ironically, to really get stuck into the writing and indeed the, I'll call it playing, the development of the piece. It's not all about death or grief. No. There are, I have a conversation with my voice. That's another strong element where I'm kind of, voice is stroppy, and she's fairly defiant and she wants to sing some songs and I want to sing other songs. And we do have this conversation about our work life. We have a very deep conversation about the environment that we work in being very much dominated by men and how difficult that can be at times. But we also try to come up with ways to deal with that. I think, I don't know if people know, but I am doing a lot of work with a group called Fair Play, which really has tried to talk about the difficulties of being a woman, particularly in traditional and folk music. And so there's very thorny and difficult subjects to speak about. But I suppose my political activism has bled into my art. Yeah. And I think it's important like that as a woman. I'm speaking about art.
Yes.
And trying to channel that through my art. So I think that's a huge part of this, is me trying to project into the future and ask, what do we want for women in Ireland? And, for me, I have voice actually comes to my rescue and says, well, if we projected 20 years into the future, let's say we took a four-year-old from today, we could call her Grania, and she's a brown-skinned girl from Ennis, and we project her 20 years into the future, and we want her to be able to go to the session in peace. We want her to be able to wear whatever she likes. We want her to lead the tunes, sing whatever songs she wants. We want her then to go out and play in the dark to the ocean, look at the stars, and then to be able to walk home and not have to double check, look over her shoulder, not have to double check when she's taking the key out of her door, and for her to be safe. And I think that's a lot of this.
Yeah, is in there.
Pieces about that.
A brilliant set of aspirations, I would have to say, and many of them so simple and should be easily afforded to any human being. And so it's great that you're actually putting it out there to remind us this is what everybody
Thank
deserves.
You.
Let's talk a little bit about Dublin Airport car park. You said
about
the heron for your mother. The hare is important here. What kind of a creature is the hare for you?
Well, the hare, this is actually a true story. I come off a flight from America and I was wrecked, and I was after drinking a load of coffee, and I got into the car in the Dublin airport and car park, and the car broke down, which kind of happened a good bit. And then I was like, oh, Jesus, here we are. And then I kind of opened my eyes and there was this hare in front of me just standing there. There are a lot of hares actually in Dublin. And so I've kind of shifted her into a magic woman or on spare van. And she comes in and kind of conjure her up as a magic woman. She's an environmentalist. And so she has a kind of a little poem about how important it is to be looking after her environment. Well, she's kind of given out. She says, look,
do you know, I have it here. So why don't we let her speak for herself?
Okay, yes.
She might give out to you if you tell all her story. we'll have a listen to it and I'll come back to you at the end of this, Karen. This is Dublin Airport Car Park. Stay where you are now. Don't be going anywhere. Karen Casey from her show, I Walked Into My Head.
Glad to be back in the grey after 6 weeks of sunshine. The old bones were missing the ache and longing for home. The old rain falls softly. The old rain falls softly. A gentle veil of mist.
That's Dublin Airport Car Park section there. I was going to say a track from Karen Casey, but Karen, we can't call it that really. It is a section from the show I Walked Into My Head. Is that exactly how it works, Karen? This kind of, is it a mix of spoken word, bit of music here and there, and then that scary character of hair? I don't know if I want her telling me, I don't know if I want her giving me a dressing down.
Yeah, well, I'm blessed as well to have been really working with Niall Vallely, who did an awful lot of the lovely sound design. Mm. So Niall is, it is a mixture of songs and then me telling stories and then sound design and piano. I'm going to be playing the piano as well. So it's a kind of a blend of all of those different things.
There was one line in the midst of that that, of course, has taken on a whole new meaning. You were talking about coming back off tour, and the line in the spoken section beforehand that you give us is, glad to be back in the grey after 6 weeks. After 6 weeks of sunshine. Lots of people saying that now after 6 days.
Yes, exactly. I'm looking out at the rain here, actually, the plants. We all love it. Yes.
Putting your own experiences, as you've touched on, Karen, into a theatre show like this, do you feel much more exposed than you would in a song?
Yes. Yeah, I feel a bit terrified. Yeah, I am. And I am taking a risk. But at the same time, I feel really exhilarated and I can't wait to get up there. And I'm really looking forward to, we're having a tech rehearsal, like with lights and all the sound crew. And so I can't wait. Sarah Jane Shields is doing the lights and Alan Doherty will be making a film about the whole thing. Well, so look, Jesus, I'm absolutely blessed. I'm being held and really... It's really extraordinary.
Just wondered about that tech rehearsal. Now, you would have a sound check as a singer, and a sound check before a gig, I suppose, might take an hour or something like that. You do know that a technical rehearsal for a theatre show can go on for a day or two. Yeah, you're ready for that?
Yeah. Not really. Well, I think I'll be taking in the experience and probably practicing my lines, hopefully, in my head.
Also, songs included here, New Baby and Daughter Dear. So you might give us a little bit of the story behind those two.
New Baby is about Muireann, my eldest, when she was born. And it's...
And what age is she now?
I suppose... She's actually 21. She'll probably kill me, actually, talking about her on the radio. But hi, Muireann. Then the daughter, Dear, is speaking to both of my daughters, Anya and Muireann. And it's kind of going back as well to my mother and what my mother would say to me and what I would say to them. So I suppose continuing that long. Yeah.
Well, listen, if either Muireann or Anya give you grief about mentioning him on the radio, threaten them with the hair at Dublin Airport. That'll keep them quiet. Listen, best of luck with it all, Karen, and lovely to speak with you again this evening. That's Karen Casey. And I walked into my head, the title of the show that Karen was telling us about, is at the Watergate Theatre in Kilkenny from the 5th through until the 8th of August. And you can get further details on kilkennyarts.ie. 20 years ago this month, a new BBC series called The Office was first aired. The comedy was based on the exploits of middle management board David Brent, and it was set in a regional branch of paper merchants Werner Hogg. It was written and directed by the then relative unknowns Stephen Merchant and Ricky Gervais. It soon became clear, however, that the cast and crew were playing a significant part in one of the most enduring comedies to be released first on UK television and then remade for US audiences. The show made household names of Merchant, Gervais, Martin Freeman and Mackenzie Crook. But has it stood the test of time? Alan Corr is here with a management questionnaire for me to answer as to whether we will get to listen to more of the Office or not in another 20 years' time. Brainchild of Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, where did the idea first come from, Alan?
Well, it's extraordinary if you cast your mind back 20 years ago, the very humble beginnings of The Office, considering how iconic certain parts of The Office have become. I mean, Gervais and Merchant would have met at the London radio station XFM, where Gervais was head of speech. He hired Merchant because he liked the look of his resume. And Merchant then left soon afterwards to become take part in a trainee producer course at the BBC. Now, part of his course was to make a documentary film. So rather than do something boring, he made a mockumentary film called CD Boss. So that became the basis for The Office. So, you know, considering that Merchant and Gervais were first-time writers and first-time directors, this was extraordinary. And they approached the whole thing, as I say, a mockumentary. There's no laughter track. There were shaky handheld cameras. The cast looked like real people. So, I mean, stuff like Spinal Tap would have been an influence on it, but also docu-shows, docudrama shows like Driving School and Airport, which were big in the late 90s, early noughties. The whole idea was giving normal people their 15 minutes of fame. So that was the beginnings of The Office, Sean.
And, you know, when you say it there about the mockumentary style, I remember seeing, it might have been like an early episode, one or two of the Office before it had made its mark. I remember thinking, is this real? Is this for real? Is this David Brent guy for real? They really did, particularly in those early episodes where it hadn't gained a reputation just yet. It took me in, and I think it took several people in because of that.
Well, I mean, that was very much the intention. Authenticity was the byword here. They really, you know, wanted to capture and make a show that looked like a genuine documentary, to the point that they were telling me, kind of the film grading guy, to lower the colour tone of everything, to make everything look washed out as possible. And the fact that it was filmed on those shaky cameras and kind of handheld cameras, and the fact that it had no laughter track, which was quite revolutionary back then, but not so much now, that did lended that authenticity of a documentary. I must say, when I saw it first, Sean, I saw the very first episode and I stumbled across it, and there was no pre-publicity done, you know, to lend it that air of the genuine article. It took me a while, like yourself, to rumble that, hang on a second, this can't be real. This has to be a comedy. And that was part of the ambiguity of the show, I think.
Well, here's a classic scene which, you know, gives a real sense of that ambiguity. We have David Brent, the Ricky Gervais character. I don't know how you even explain the style of management, bad management, non-management that David Brent has. And here he is speaking to one of the other workers in the office, Keith, played by Ewan McIntosh. And it's one of those questionnaires with boxes to be ticked. Let's have a listen.
Right, you've left this section completely blank, Keith. You haven't done the Q&A.
I thought that you filled that in.
No. This is aimed at you. Look, to what extent do you believe that you have the skills and knowledge to perform your job effectively? And then you just tick one of the boxes. Not at all, to some extent, very much so, don't know. What would you tick?
Don't know.
Okay. Question two. Do you feel you have received adequate training to use your computer effectively?
What are the options?
Same as they're always the same. Always the same. Not at all. To some extent, very much so. Don't know.
Don't know.
Don't know again. Okay. Do you feel you are given the flexibility to decide how best to accomplish your goals? Do you want the options again?
Yeah.
Not at all. To some extent, always the same. Very much so. Don't know. If don't know wasn't there, what would you put?
Well, the options...
Not at all. To some extent, very much so. Don't know.
Very much so.
Do you remember what the question was?
No.
Okay. Do you... Let's... We're going to leave that there.
Well, if there was no laughter, if there was no laughter track on the sing itself, it didn't need it because every house, and even as I listen back, I don't know how many times I've heard that scene in the last 20 years.
Yeah,
it just they never lose. It's the reality of it. It's the realness of it that makes it so funny.
Very much so. And I think, you know, the show was all about the dull groundhog grind of office life, Sean. The routine, the sometimes mind-numbing repetition and the minor victories and awkward moments. So we just saw kind of the kind of thing that David Brent has to do there as a manager. This was a show that I suppose was all about how people saw themselves and how other people saw them. So it was all about self-delusion. It was all about kind of, you know, getting through the dull grind of the day, because bearing in mind we often spend most of our time with our colleagues, much more so than our friends and family, and I think Merchant and Gervais captured that kind of atmosphere of the hard slog and trying to bring some joy into your working life.
Yeah, well, we did for the last 18 and a half years of the 20 years of The Office. For the last year and a half we had a very different experience of what office life might have been. I'm afraid to say something like we've all met David Brent in our day, because I'm not sure if we have all met a David Brent in our day. But how did he manage to make that character so instantly funny, eminently dislikable, but you couldn't take your eyes off him?
Well, he's a very, you know, again, an ambiguous character, because he is... He's pretty grotesque in a lot of ways. I mean, he's essentially a narcissistic man-child. He's no filter, he's no self-awareness, he's no judgment, and he's a huge ego. And he tries to operate this kind of unorthodox management style, but what he ends up doing is just alienating everybody. So he wants to be this maverick boss, but also a comedian, an entertainer who makes life fun, you know. But, you know, despite all the things we feel about him, we pity him, we revile him as well, Sean, but, you know, we also want him the best for him, you know. And the clever thing about The Office is that it went from being merely a comedy, if that's the right expression, into kind of something that was a very good drama as well. And I think we wanted to follow David Brent's, you know, character development. And it is a journey of redemption for David Brent and for a lot of the other characters on the show.
Well, let's have a listen to another clip that gives us a sense of the kind of childishness that goes on in offices in certain places around the world, I'm sure, over things like staplers. Here's Gareth, played by Mackenzie Cook, David, once again, Ricky Gervais, and Martin Freeman, who has been misbehaving with Gareth's stapler.
Right, that is it.
Slow down, you move too fast. Solomon's here. All part of the job. What's going on?
Put my stapler inside a jelly again. That's the third time he's done it. It wasn't even funny the first time.
Why has he done that?
Just told him once that I don't like jelly. Don't trust the way it moves.
Yeah, you showed him a weakness. He pounced. You should know about that. Oh, what is it then?
It's my stapler.
Well, don't do that. Well, eat it out. There's people starving in the world, which I hate. So, and it's a waste. So, how do you know it's yours?
Because it's got my name on it in Tippex.
Yeah, don't eat it now. In chemicals.
Right, you can be my witness. Give him an official warning.
How do you know it was me?
It's always you. Can't you discipline him?
Oh, kinky!
No, the thing about practical jokes is you've got to know when to stop as well as start, and now's the time to stop putting Gareth's personal possessions in jelly, all right?
Gareth, it's only a trifling matter.
Here we go. We're always like this.
You should put him in custody.
He's going to fit in here. We're like Vic and Bob, aren't we? And one extra one. Oh, God.
Yeah, I'm more worried, really, about damage to company property, that's all.
And that's Gareth, played by Mackenzie Crook, David, played by Ricky Gervais, and Martin Freeman in the part of Tim there. And that's a wonderfully childish scene from The Office and what happens to a staper if you admit your weakness. Of course, the real bit of the Martin Freeman story that I remember, and we were all hooked on this as it took a little break for a while, Will They, Won't They? The romance between Don and Don, played by Lucy Davis, and Tim, played by Martin Freeman. It almost became a bit of a rom-com in that respect. How did they manage to hold that balance with the kind of, you know, stupidness of the rest of it?
I thought it was done very cleverly. One of the great kind of sitcom greats, Richard Curtis, who wrote such sitcoms as Blackadder and The Vicar of Dibley, he said of The Office, it got better in ways that he never expected. And he described Don and Tim's romance as one of the great romantic stories of all time in drama. And I would have to agree with him. It was absolutely gripping. So Don, played by Lucy Davis, and Tim, as you say, played by Martin Freeman, a future Bilbo Baggins, of course, in Peter Jackson's movies. So she was the receptionist. He was the sales rep. And they clearly fancied each other something rotten. But unfortunately for Tim anyway, Don already had a boyfriend down in the warehouse, Wernham Hogg's warehouse. So the trajectory of their romance over the two seasons, it was foiled, it was on and off, you know, and, you know, they're both very, very nice people. So it really did capture hearts and minds. I mean, this was a show that kind of, you know, weaponized, you know, humiliation. It weaponized that kind of sense of awkwardness when people are being kind of idiots, basically. Mm-hmm. But underneath it, it had this beautiful softness to it with Tim and Dawn. And, you know, if you haven't seen the show, maybe you should watch it.
Oh, yes, and we don't want to tell anybody.
How it works out for them.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm sure those type of office romances go on in offices around the world as well, Alan.
They sure do.
14 episodes. Again, it's the thing, you've heard it a million times. You go, were there really only 14 episodes? There's a touch of the Fawlty Towers in that respect of The Office, isn't there?
There certainly is. I'm sure that was a conscious thing by Gervais and Merchant to keep it that way. Because if you look at the American version, which went on for 9 seasons, and which I must say, Sean, I didn't like. It missed the point of the show. I mean, it's been licensed and franchised to 10 separate countries around the world. But the original version, as you say, is 12 episodes and the 2-part Christmas season in 2003, I think it was, which was absolutely superb. So it's kind of interesting to think that, you know, considering that these two guys, Gervais and Merchant, were pioneers of that kind of sofa-squirming, knuckle-gnawing comedy of embarrassment, they managed to put so much into those 14 episodes. And that's like essentially, 7 hours of television. And it still stands as one of the great kind of monuments of the great British sitcom. And it does bear, you know, comparisons with Fawlty Towers in that respect.
And do you think when you watch it now, 20 years on, are there aspects of it that has dated, or essentially, you know, office politics are office politics no matter where and when you are?
Nope. Anytime it's on TV, I will watch it again. And I think that's part of the key to the success of The Office, that you can watch it again. I think the big question is, would they get away with it now, considering that we're in this kind of, you know, the time of culture wars and woke wars?
So, political correctness was not in the minds of any of these characters, certainly.
No. Absolutely not. And, you know, certain shows now from the 1970s, you know, what we might say the more Jurassic Age of comedy, when they're shown on television now, they come with what I call woke warnings before transmission, to warn people about kind of subjects such as racism and homophobia and stuff like that, which I disagree with, because I don't think you should tamper with art in that way. So Gervais asked the question recently, would a show like The Office be made? And naturally, when he made the points, he got himself into hot water on Twitter, and he had to explain what he meant. He was merely kind of speculating whether it would get commissioned or not, given the fact that we're involved in these kind of identity wars where people are sitting at home waiting to be offended. It hasn't dated remotely, Sean. If you look at it now, and I look at it all the time, it's still as relevant and still as funny as ever.
Well, I don't know, it would be important to point out that there were many people who would argue that those warnings at the beginning of comedies and indeed films as well, that they're important for just to alert us to the type of thing that is going on, wasn't acceptable then, and it's not acceptable then, so we need to allow a bit of balance in that particular opinion. But let's finish with a scene. This is Brent leaving the office. It looks as if he's got very broad horizons ahead of him. All is good in the world of David Brent as he leaves, Alan.
Yes, but we, you know, as long as we don't have to see him again, I wouldn't like us to revisit these characters for another special one-off. But Brent does leave on a high note.
Right. Thanks to Alan Corther, helping us mark 20 years of The Office. And here's David Brent, a.k.a. Ricky Gervais, saying goodbye.
I don't look upon this like it's the end. I look upon it like it's moving on, you know. It's almost like my work here's done. You know, I can't imagine Jesus going, oh, I've told a few people here in Bethlehem I'm the Son of God. Can I just stay here with Mum and Dad now? No, you got to move on. You got to spread the word. You know, you got to go to Nazareth, please. And that's very much like me. My world does not end with these four walls. Slough's a big place, you know. And when I finish with Slough, there's Reading, Aldershot, Bracknell. You know, I've got a Didcot, Yateley, you know, my Winnersh, Taplow, you know, because I am my own boss. I can Burfield. I can wake up one morning and go, oh, I don't feel like working today. Can I just stay in bed? Oh, I don't know. You better ask the boss. David, can I stay in bed all day? Yes, you can, David. Both me. That's not me in bed with another bloke called David.
There you go. David Brent, Ricky Gervais playing the part there in that scene from The Office. Alan Corr helping us mark 20 years of the comedy series just before that clip. Of a Mind is the title of a new guided audio experience show that will be coming to Bray, County Wicklow from August the 4th. 50 audience members at a time will be brought on a guided audio performance around Bray seafront, all connected via Zoom, in what the show's producer describes as a love letter to Bray. The show has been put together by Irish dramaturg and producer and Bray resident Hugh Farrell and his collaborator, sound designer Tyler Kiefer from Brooklyn, New York, and both of them joining me this evening. I say Bray resident, but in fact, former Bray resident. Is now the case, Hugh?
That's right, yeah. I lived in Bray for the last 5 years and moved out recently. My housemates had a baby, so I left to give them my room. And I've moved into Ranelagh now, but I've loved Bray so much living there. It's got a lot going for it. Beautiful seafront, a lot of nature and great people. So we're really excited to make this show.
And how quickly did you become aware when you moved back to Bray of the soundscape all around you? When did that start to filter into your ears in a way that you thought, oh, I can do something with this?
Yeah, so we've always been kind of tuned into this. We've been making this style of work for about 5 or 6 years now. And Tyler will speak a little more about this, but we record with binaural microphones. And for want of a better description, they kind of capture a 3D sound picture. So what we started to do in our first shows was go around Ireland and try to capture the sounds of an average day in Ireland. And by accumulating tons and tons of recordings, you know, we have a great recording of the guy who sells the newspaper in Cork, the Evening Echo, and he just has this beautiful ring to his voice and how he sells the paper. So we started collecting all those kind of, yeah, cultural sounds from the country, and that becomes part of our soundscape then for the shows.
And Tyler, had you seen or did you know anything about Bray before you heard the recordings of Bray?
Well, no. My first time visiting was, I guess, 6 years ago now. I think this is my 7th time to Ireland. And in that time, you know, Hugh and I were developing work for other festivals around the country, but Bray was really sort of our incubator for ideas. So we were recording a lot at the time. And what's really exciting about this go around is, you know, there's a lot of sounds that are kind of silenced in these days of isolation and lockdown. So we somewhat have a bit of a oral time machine that we can kind of transport people back to the lively sounds that was the seafront before all of this.
Yeah, well, in fact, let's have a little section from the work. This is Of a Mind. It's the Bray song, and this is your composer. There's a composer involved, Hugh, Kevin McNamara.
Yeah,
he's performing here as well. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, Kevin has he goes by the name Rain on Tent, and sometimes Henry Prune. And he whipped up this little ditty for us. And then what you'll hear now is a kind of a soundscape of Bray's sounds.
Biore for the Biore, why it's so cold on the streets of Bray. Biore for the Biore, why it's so cold on the streets of Bray.
It's Bandstand struck in 1961. It was made for the Dublin Exhibition in 1970.
This track is for Gray.
And that, a little ditty called Bray Song, B-R-E for the B-R-A-Y, Bray.
Yeah.
And with me in studio this evening, Hugh Farrell and Tyler Kiefer, who are making this guided audio experimental show called Of a Mind. The first thing that, when I heard that clip first, I thought, that's the sound of the Dart. It's unmistakable. You know, it's not, the Lewis has a different sound,
exactly.
The bus has a different sound. You just recognise it immediately.
Yeah, it's that hum that kind of lifts up and... Yeah, and I love just hearing that, you know, every time I got home to Bray, you know, that you get into the last stop and it says the next stop is Bray, Bray.
Yeah, because it's giving the name in both Irish and English.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And the B-R-E for the sounds exactly the same as B-R-A-Y.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so those sounds are just kind of all pulled from Bray. And that's not all we have, you know, like we've got great recordings from the pubs and stuff in Bray from before the pandemic and, you know, trad musicians and things like that.
And the other thing that struck me about the Dart in particular, Tyler, and you probably speak to the technical side of this, that idea of the Dart, even when you're standing in the station and it pulls in and then it pulls off, you really hear it coming towards you and you hear it going off into the distance. That's what this technical method of recording allows you to give, that experience in the head.
Yeah, it gives a much more realistic picture of what we're hearing around us. And it's interesting you talk about that, of really instantly recognizing this is the Dart, it's not the Lewis. You know, there's, our walk is also about kind of these things that we notice and perceive all the time but might not actually clock them or think about, and sort of kind of slowing down and heightening our awareness to really be able to pick those things out and realize all the other sounds that are constantly around us.
And for somebody who maybe is from Bray or who isn't, who lived in Bray as a kid and moved away, maybe living abroad, that sound will be so nostalgic and so immediately recognizable, Hugh. That must be part of the plan.
Totally, yeah. There's a big leaning into nostalgia here. I sometimes say that this show was born out of a nostalgia for going to Mass, actually. And the reason I say that is that we, as a culture, we used to have a ritual where we used to go, or and still do to some extent, but where we used to go somewhere every Sunday and see and be seen by our community. And you'd notice if someone was missing or if someone wasn't very well or something like that. And it was a way to just check in with each other. And I feel that ritual is really important and we need it. It's one of the oldest ways we have to heal ourselves. So this experience is a chance to kind of lean into the nostalgia of for those kinds of things that I think we need after this pandemic.
And while the second piece of audio that I have here doesn't speak directly to going to Mass, it does bring us into a church. You might talk to us here, Tyler, about what you were hoping to achieve in the way you recorded this, because we just get this sense of, you know, a vast space, but a very quiet space, actually, in a peculiar type of way.
Yeah, it was really incredible recording in the Pro Cathedral. One of my favorite parts, actually, was standing inside in silence and just hearing the seagulls go crazy outside, and it sounded like they were in the church. But there's this beautiful acoustics and architecture of things mixing together. And again, with this sort of binaural audio recording technique, we're able to, in this case, sort of transport people to another environment altogether. So while you're out on the beach, it sounds all of a sudden like there are four walls around you, and your environment that you're hearing doesn't really match up with what you're seeing. And that juxtaposition can lead to some really exciting moments.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Cathedral Voices then. The vocalist here is Shane Sugru. Used to sing with, he sang with Anuna at one stage along the way,
that's,
I think.
Right, yeah.
And your composer, Kevin McNamara, present here as well at the Pro Cathedral in Dublin City Centre, and create an amazing soundscape here for us.
Thank you.
section there from Cathedral Voices, which is part of a show called Of a Mind. And with me in studio speaking about the show this evening are Hugh Farrell and Tyler Kiefer. I watched Hugh as you were listening to the beginning of that, your eyes automatically closed, and it has that meditative feel for it. It feeds into the title of your production company, Listen and Breathe.
That's right. Yeah, we call ourselves Listen and Breathe because it's our shortcut to accessing a present state of mind. And I kind of remember when it first clicked with me, you know, people talk about meditation a lot and it can be hard to access or to know whether you're doing it right or whatever. And I remember it kind of clicking with me once when I started listening very intently to the sounds around me and tuning into things that were far away or just the hum of electricity in the room or something like that. And then as my mind started to wander and my thoughts started to flip back in, I would flip my attention to focusing on my breathing. And then the same process would happen. And I just kept flip-flopping between those two things. And I found when I was stressed out or whatever, it would really calm me down.
And very interesting to think that those who are doing the walk with you in Bray will be outside. And if they close their eyes, suddenly they can bring themselves into whatever space they want to be in with that music. I'm wondering, Tyler, for you, when you're over here, do you have to put on a little soundtrack of Brooklyn or of New York in your ears at some point along the way just to stop yourself from getting homesick?
Well, it's funny you say that because in Brooklyn, I do have this above ground train right next to my apartment that I sort of miss the rhythm of. But, you know, Ireland's got its whole other rhythm. And being down by Bray at the seafront has just been such a privilege. And really, I call it paradise sometimes. I mean, just the rhythm of the sea out there is gorgeous.
Yeah, I like that you sort of miss the overhead railway. I can imagine how after a couple of nights of that, probably when you go back, it's hard to get back into sleep with that happening around you. You're developing another show at the moment as well, Hugh, called, it's with the Michelin star chef Kevin Thornton, Every Year I Grow Again.
Yeah, Feast is the short title we give it. Mm. It's a show we've been developing for about 5 years and now we're developing with Kevin Thornton, as you say. In 2018, we were brought out to America by a production company in LA called New Neighborhood, and Roland Jones, who's the lead producer there, he's a writer for HBO, funded a production, a kind of pilot production. So we worked with a chef out in Nantucket Island. Mm-hmm. And to create that show, Tyler and Nick, our video designer, came out to Ireland at first, and we traveled around most of Leinster, interviewing farmers, fishers, brewers, beekeepers, oyster farmers, all sorts of to people to try and figure out where our food comes from and to try and recreate the ritual of a meal together.
Yeah, so that sense of ritual is obviously very important to you in all that you're doing. I'd save this one to the end because I didn't want to kind of pull the air out of the event before we started speaking about it. Obviously, you're using Zoom technology.
Yeah.
And immediately I hear people go, oh, no, not another Zoom meeting.
Yeah.
How do you think you get past that? Is it being in the actual environment?
So we're using Zoom, but we were very clear when Mermaid approached us and commissioned the work that we wanted to make something that did not have a screen in it. Mm. We're all really sick of our screens. So what we're actually using Zoom for is just to synchronize everyone's audio in the headphones. And Zoom's technology has really improved over the years. So it's now a ready-made product that allows us to use people's smartphones and headphones to connect each other.
And you don't have to worry about your background or what's
happening
in the house.
Yeah, exactly. You'll just be out there hands-free with your headphones on. Yeah. And
all right. Of a Mind, the show is, Of a Mind is the title of the show, is produced by Listen and Breathe. It will kick off on Wednesday next, August the 4th, continues through until August the 15th. Tickets and further information from the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray, and their website is mermaidartscentre.ie. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.